Radio Gag, the Gays Against Guns show. Prepare to gag, yeah.
Greetings, listeners, and welcome to Radio Gag, the Gays Against Guns show. Radio Gag is your update on how to end the horror that is the American gun violence epidemic. Your hosts today are Gag president and full-time activist J.W. Walker and me, Libby Edwards. On our show today, Sarah Lilly will give us the latest GVP news, and with our guest, A.C. Dedeschi, we will discuss the right-wing Republican plan to dismantle American democracy. It's a harrowing plot that reads like a dystopian fiction, but it is all too real. But first, our In Memoriam.
In Memoriam, Savannah Ryan Williams. Savannah Ryan Williams, a 38-year-old Cuban and native trans woman, was shot and left for dead on November 29, 2023 in Minneapolis. The suspect was charged with second-degree murder. Williams' partner of 7 years, Courtney Mason, remembered her love of movies and music by Beyoncé and Drake. She was a very loving, caring person, Mason said. Williams' sister, Gabrielle Stilday, said that her big sister had a big heart. Stilday's kids said Williams was their favorite auntie. Savannah is our superstar, Stilday said. She meant the world to me and my kids. She was very loved by our family. Please don't judge her because she wouldn't judge you. Williams' cousin, Raylynn Stilday, said her cousin was outgoing and outspoken and lit up every room she walked in. We are so sad she is gone and heartbroken. Even though Savannah is gone, her legacy will live on forever. At the time of Savannah's murder, Amber Moom, an outreach and prevention specialist and co-leader of Tea Time, a local support network for trans women, noted that it had been the third violent attack on the local LGBTQ community. Williams' friends, loved ones, and members of the Minnesota State House's Queer Legislative Caucus called on lawmakers to do more to ensure the state safety of all residents, particularly trans women of color like Williams, who are disproportionately targets of violence. Amber Moom and Tea Time have called on Minnesota to ban the trans panic defense, a dangerous legal strategy that has been used to justify murder, and to treat the killing of trans people as a hate crime. Amber said Williams' death has rocked their community, and members are still processing the loss. Savannah was fierce, full of life. She had a big personality and an even bigger heart. She is going to be dearly, dearly missed. Savannah Ryan Williams, we remember you.
This is Sarah Germaine Lilly reporting for Radio Gag, the National Gun Violence Prevention News from Every Town for Gun Safety. New York, Every Town for Gun Safety released the following statement to commemorate Transgender Day of Visibility, Sunday, March 31st, 2024. Gun violence deeply affects the transgender community and the broader queer community. While Transgender Day of Visibility is meant to be a moment to celebrate trans excellence, violence against the trans community continues to rise at an alarming rate. In reflecting on this year in which hate-motivated gun violence impacted many LGBTQ+ community members, it is crucial to acknowledge the disproportionate effect gun violence has on marginalized communities and the work that must be done to disarm hate in the U.S. Every Town's new research reveals there have been 263 transgender homicides in the last 7 years through the end of 2023, with approximately three-quarters of these homicides involving a gun. The report underscores the urgency to address gun violence as a key factor in these tragic deaths. Another stark revelation from the study is the disproportionate impact on Black transgender women, who represent a substantial majority of the victims, further magnified by the prevalence of firearm use in these crimes. Today should be a celebration of resilience, but it also serves as a stark reminder of the disproportionate violence endured by the trans community, said Angela Farrell Zabala, Executive Director of Moms Demand Action. This research affirms a troubling trend we've observed for years. Weak gun safety laws, coupled with bigotry, place trans individuals at deadly risk, particularly Black trans women. Our movement remains committed to centering their stories, celebrating their joy, and advocating for lawmakers to disarm hate. Nearly half of these incidents involving guns are in southern states, too many of which have both lax gun safety laws and proposed or enacted legislation targeting transgender people for unequal treatment. There is a direct line between policy decisions and the safety of marginalized communities, said Sarah Bird Sharps, Senior Director of Research at Everytown for Gun Safety. In order to keep trans and gender expansive people safe, lawmakers at every level must take action to prioritize legislation that protects individuals from hate crimes motivated by a victim's gender identity. This tragic trend isn't happening in a vacuum. Transgender people are 2.5 times as likely to be victims of violence as cisgender people, and it comes as legislators in states across the country have been waging war against the rights of the trans community. Media and law enforcement also have a duty to respect and affirm people's names and genders, not only out of respect for their loved ones and communities, but also so that research on the ongoing violence against transgender people is accurately understood and represented. There is much more work to be done to prevent gun violence against the LGBTQ plus community. A vital part of the solution to this problem is to have comprehensive research that develops a deeper understanding of the intersection between gun violence and the queer community, including firearm suicide, in order to find the best solution. Everytown for Gun Safety Support Fund has tracked homicides of transgender and gender expansive people in the U.S. since 2017. In addition to breaking down gun violence to the state and county level, the platform includes a database of known trans or gender nonconforming homicide victims in the United States. Thank you, Everytown for Gun Safety. This is Sarah Germaine Lilly reporting for Radio Gag.
In a 17-page introduction to the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 Mandate for Leadership, its president, Kevin Roberts, lays out the right wing's promise to America, which should be required reading for every voter in this country. It reeks of imagined victimization and the desire for revenge if Trump should win the presidency in the upcoming election. The Mandate for Leadership is a 920-page document that outlines the way in which our democratic institutions and agencies would be reshaped to reflect only the values of ultra-conservatives. It is a daunting document, but fortunately, Stop the Coup 2025 has read it all and has summarized each section to explain the impact this plan will have on our lives. Our guest today and Christine Dedeschi will help us examine two aspects of the manifesto. AC launched the Stop the Coup 2025 campaign in December 2023, bringing together 150 New York City and US LGBTQIA+ activists to mobilize against Project 2025. AC is an award-winning independent journalist, the author of four books, a feminist, and a longtime human rights, gender equality, and HIV activist. She currently does investigative stories and media advocacy about Project 2025, as well as addressing the influence of U.S. Christian evangelical groups who are pushing the anti-gender agenda in Africa. Welcome, AC. This is such a big topic. Could you please give us your view of Project 2025 overall, and then discuss how the LGBTQIA+ community would be affected by its restrictive agenda?
First of all, a greeting to you guys, and thank you so much for the opportunity to speak out. I think the most important thing for people to know is that when someone tells you what they want to do, you have an advantage because then you actually know what they want to do and you can organize yourself in response. And so you're quite right. that the conservative movement of the US has come up with a very detailed plan for how they want to retake power. And as they put it, dismantle the quote unquote administrative state. What it really means is that compared to many years past, the conservative movement has organized itself to bring together a lot of the more extreme groups and actors. And they've been able to do that in particular this time compared to the past, because they have an advantage of a lot of money and some billionaires that have helped to fund this. But to put it in context, Project 2025 is called a mandate for leadership because every 4 years since the last 30 years, or really since Reagan, which was the first mandate for leadership, the conservative movement kind of comes together to say, this is what we want our platform to be. This is what we want the next administration to do. In this case, what they've done is they've built on some of the past, but their goal was to specifically, really in some ways, look at what didn't happen under the first Trump regime and make sure that that wasn't repeated. And there were specific things they wanted to do. So compared to the past, what they've done is bring together a lot of the people in the conservative movement who served in the Trump administration in the one or two or three positions. And they gave each of them the task of looking at a department of government and saying, what would need to change for our agenda to be implemented? And so Project 2025 is a big instruction book, very detailed, chapter by chapter, department by department. And it includes essentially two pieces that I think are important. One of them is that it is, as you say, a recipe for autocracy. It would give the next president an unprecedented degree of power to the executive branch, and it would limit the ability of either the courts, which are actually very bought in any case, and the Congress to be able to prevent in some ways the changing of the levers of government, the really dismantling of the bureaucracy of the federal government. It would also, it seeks to, in any case, try to put or remove from power a lot of the apolitical federal workforce and put in place partisans. They were hoping to put in 20,000 Christian loyalists. The second piece is the Christian part, which is this is also a blueprint for a future Christian theocracy. This is the Christian nationalist movement. And so I just want to take a minute to talk about who's behind it. It's very important for people to know this. This is a long-term plan. This is the long game. And the long game began with the Christian Coalition in the 90s, Reagan and stuff. But it's really been put together by, among others, Leonard Leo, who was a Christian right attorney. He's a Catholic activist and militant. He was the person who, as we know, handpicked at least five, arguably six of the Supreme Court justices. There's also Charles Koch, who, as people know, is billionaire. So there's about six or eight billionaire families that have helped put in money. But the big money came in 2022 when Leonard Leo, via his connections to the Federalist Society, which is the legal body, was able to get his hands on $1.6 billion from a Chicago industrialist named Barry Sade. And they've used that money to basically bankroll this plan. And they've given it to a lot of the conservative groups that are currently putting the plan in place now by doing what has been ongoing for some time, which is the continuation of judicial activism, putting in place laws and changes of law or bringing forward conservative interpretations of law that would provide essentially the legal basis for this coup that they envision, this administrative coup. So I want to just say one more thing about this that I think is so important. If it was enacted, Project 2025 would in fact have what we would consider the template for a dictatorship. It would put in place a system of government that we have never seen. It would remove many, many federal protections and many rights. And we're going to talk today about the LGBTQIA plus movement, but it's also really such a, we call it kind of an equal opportunity attack. There is no sector of the American society, you know, that is not attacked. And that's why we feel it's so important. And also that it really impacts every American and many non-Americans too. Of course, the attack on immigrants is just so extreme. So we feel like most importantly, people need to familiarize themselves with this document, understand it's not just a theoretical thing. understand it's already, unhappening, but also understand that we are the majority. That the majority of American people, if they know what's in this plan, will not be in support of it. This is not a lefty thing. This is not a centrist thing. This is a broad attack on American democracy and our fundamental system of government. So I think with that, we can talk some more details, but we are in the majority. And so in some ways, our job between now and maybe the election, right? It's not about Trump. It's not about Biden. It's about what the American people want. We have to tell people about this plan and also that we have many tools to fight back.
What are some of the tools that we might be able to use?
Well, what's interesting is that as I've looked at it, I've been working on this really since about October. In every area, whether you're looking at the attacks on DEI, you're looking at the school boards, you're looking at library bans, people have learned how to fight back and have won in specific at state levels and in regional levels and things. And so while the attack is massive, like, whatever, there's maybe 100 DEI, anti-DEI things being put forward in a kind of, systematic way by these people who are advisors to Project 2020. We've also seen how people can fight back. And it's a matter of understanding what the attack actually is, understanding their specific tools you can use. So, whether it's a school board that organizes itself in advance to say, we're going to do this and this and this in our school. It's specific, but we've learned a lot, and including cases. The ACLU, of course, has won a number of cases. We're seeing this happen. I think what's most important is that the whole goal, I think, of Project 2025 was to write this giant document that was so overwhelming that nobody could put their hands around it. I mean, that's why we were like, we have to break this down. Who is going to read a nearly 1,000-page kind of wonky policy document? Well, we did. And we did it because we understood that this is actually far more dangerous than even arguably something like the Capitol, where it turned into a riot, which turned into an attempt, which was an organized attempt to, deny an election and overthrow the will of the people, right? This is the people who know the government, who understand that this is how you change the levers of power. The other piece that I think is important for listeners to understand is that some of the ideas of this include a lot of social policy, which is the piece about anti-diversity. We consider it a very white supremacy document, anti-LGBTQ, et cetera. The social policy in many ways is modeled after what has happened in Hungary under the Orban regime, which is an autocracy, some of it also from Poland. And so many of the people who are in the Project 2025 orbit, these include 100 conservative groups. It's led by the Heritage Foundation, a lot of Federalist Society, GOP lawyers and legal firms have been kind of helping out. But you're talking about a lot of the most extreme conservative movements, Alliance for Defending Freedom, et cetera. They, in 2022, not only did Leonard Leo get a big chunk of money, but they went over to Hungary and met with the Orban regime folks to understand how did they do what they did. And they came back and they wrote Project 2025. And they took what they knew about their own experience as the number one or the number two, whether it's Department of Labor or Justice or, the FCC, they know how the administration runs. And then they really focused on policy. Policy and the people in policy is their plan. And so they've written this whole thing, and now we can see what they want to do. And we also can know what happened under Orban. So for us, as people who are saying to people, we need to stop this, we are applying that same analytical, break it down, present it to the American people response. And we're bringing forward the lessons. There are lessons from places like Hungary, lessons from Poland, and there are lessons from our own movement.
So just as an example, what would happen if this were implemented? What would be the impact on the LGBTQIA plus population?
Yeah. I would say that there are three groups that are extremely criminalized by this plan. One of them is immigrants, including undocumented folks who are trying to come here because they're fleeing persecution. LGBTQIA, in particular, transgender and non-binary people. Those are I'd say in a broad way, also people who are poor in America, which includes, a lot of folks. As I mentioned, this is a very white supremacy document. So we really see the impact on brown and black communities, but we also see them in other communities, whether it's Native American, whether it's Latino. So with LGBTQ, this document cites and it states its intention, which is to remove all mention of LGBTQIA+ or gender or gender identity from all federal rules and regulations, which means you're removing it from all protection. It means it's reversing the gains of the, you know, LGBTQIA+ movement in these years. So we're talking about the goal, for example, of implementing a federal Don't Say Gay bill. We're talking about reversing gay marriage, adoption, military. But you're also removing the possibility of, when you take away, for example, DEI, it's also removing all DEI policies, removing civil rights agencies from the federal government, which means that you are not only removing or addressing the possibility of, you know, looking at discrimination that might be happening, whether it's in employment or housing, et cetera, you're also removing the ability of people who may be facing discrimination to have recourse. There are other things you're doing. You're removing the documentation of LGBTQIA life and experience. So, you know, you can't make an argument that people should get funding or need programs when you don't have any data about them. It's making people invisible and criminalizing. It's also, for example, with transgender and non-binary, it's criminalizing, it's equating that identity with pornography, which is considered a crime. It goes so far as to say that we should be, that people who are like, for example, librarians who are promoting, as they say, books that might have that kind of content, or people who are speaking out about that issue themselves should be arrested, should be treated like sex offenders. It's criminalizing a class of people. And it goes a step further, which we've seen in other countries when we talk about, you know, how do things like autocracy and even, you know, genocides happen? You're making the people who are the providers of services to that class of people criminalize themselves. So, for example, medical providers or health providers of gender-affirming care or services to people who are seeking treatment for gender dysphoria, which is, you know, transgender and non-binary people who may be seeking that service, they're making that a crime. It's the same way as we see, and it's borrowing in many ways from the anti-abortion movement, where they want to make a federal ban on abortion, they want to criminalize all abortion, and they want to say that if you're a doctor or a health provider who's providing those services, you are a criminal too, and they want to go after them. And we're already seeing this in this country. We've seen what's happened to providers of reproductive care services or abortion clinics and things, where there's an attempt to criminalize them, there's an attempt to go after. So this is very much both building on the anti-abortion movement, but also in many ways, it's criminalizing gender.
It's just hard to take all of that in. I mean, that it could be so real and it could be so fast. I know everything is in place. And another thing that you mentioned to me the other day when we spoke, that another part of the plan is to shut down independent media of all sorts. So communication things would also be totally under the control of the government. Is that correct?
Yes. So what it says about media in many ways, it says that the media, and in many ways, they even name the mainstream media, is considered the enemy of the people. I mean, it's quite a statement, right? To say it, it says that the media are left-wing, anti-American, biased against conservatives, and that they're really part of the problem and not the solution. I mean, they're pitting the media, right, against the American people. And what they're calling the American people is, you know, what they consider to be, you know, married or with children. It's very specific who the American people get to be. But they say, you know, it's we the people. And what I think is most important people to understand is all of this is intentional. An autocracy or autocrats, they seek to gain control by dividing and polarizing society. So you set a certain, you name a set of people and you say, these people are dangerous. They're somehow less deserving of rights. So whether it's immigrants, you know, look at, you know, right now we see former President Trump calling immigrants, you know, animals, right? This is intentional. It's about dehumanization. And it's pitting people against one another. So you are making a set of people a threat to other people. In the same way, we saw one of the first things that happened with the Orban regime, they also took immigration as the main issue, one of the main issues that they used to kind of build their political force. And then they talked to the US, and that's where the conservative movement decided that immigration was a really good topic for them to use to organize. And so was LGBTQIA. They literally ran focus groups, the Heritage Foundation and others, to do this. And they found that this resonates, for their base, whether it's the MAGA base or conservative base. And so with the media, what they did quickly is they began to seek to delegitimize the institution of the media. It's not by accident that for years we've been hearing an attack on the faux media, right? It's seeking to say this institution should not be trusted. This institution should have less authority. And it's also doing that with government. So we're seeing in Project 2025, it's not just an attack on media, it's also an attack on the government institutions. Well, which institutions? The institutions that seek to regulate, right? The institutions that protect us. These are the regulatory institutions, the FCC, any institution, right, that might also, in some ways, make it harder for big business and corporate business to do what they do. So there's a whole piece we can talk about, the profit that's under this, the bigger business agenda. But with regard to media, I want to say a few more things. They also talk about how not just that, the American media, the US media is anti-American, but that they say that, that they're opposed to the conservative agenda. They put obstacles in the way. They want to do several things that I thought are important for listeners, of your station to know. In particular, they're seeking to defund public media, right? So we're talking about NPR and PBS. We're talking about Pacifica stations. And they really want to just kind of move the entire left of the dial and make it be less accessible for progressive voices. And we have to understand that the left of the dial is what we call a long wave kind of radio. In other words, it's radio that gets further, that has a further range, is heard by more people. And so it's very important. They want to levy broadcast fees. They want to weaponize the FCC. If they can't get rid of the FCC, they want to weaponize it and make it be that progressives have to pay if they want to get access. I think that they also are saying that, in some ways they think that the mainstream media is beholden to particular advertisers. They talk about pharma and things. And in fact, we've seen that if you really look at the media, one of the ways that the conservative movement has been able to, in so many ways, challenge the narrative is by putting out an enormous amount of disinformation using the right-wing media. I mean, Fox Radio has really been kind of a mouthpiece for, in many ways, extremist Christian nationalists. Voices. I mean, Tucker Carlson is a good example before he got fired. I mean, he went to Hungary, right? He went to study with Orban. He just talked about what an amazing plan this was. So we've seen just this real seeding in Fox Radio of normalizing ideas that are very extremist, disinformation getting normalized, and using the structure of the right-wing media. And I want to make one more comment. The reason why we think this is so important right now is particularly in the Spanish-speaking media, many of the radio stations that are used to disseminate a lot of information in, swing states, for example, like even Florida now is kind of up for grabs, right? That media is owned by Republicans. So the Democrats buy ads on it, but it's owned by Republicans. So we really have to understand that, by kind of taking control of the media, you are going to control the narrative. And what your goal is preventing dissent. Right. So that is really the goal. It's getting rid of, the conversation, like getting rid of LGBTQIA voices, but it's also preventing scrutiny. And so this whole model that is, coming in with Project 2025, it's really one of a kind of almost what we call I guess people call it more of even an oligarchy. You're coming in with one individual who is given a lot of power, right? It's the executive branch, putting in place his or her cronies, right? So the loyalists, and then removing the things that would get in the way of allowing the private sector, in particular, major corporations, of having an enormous amount of influence. They want to actually allow private sector to come in and take the place of government in many cases. They want to give the duties of the government, the duties of regulatory industries, and they want to say, no, let's let industry self-regulate, whether this is in big business, in industry, in agriculture. I think the other places where I think it's so critical to understand the danger is also in the areas of climate. What this Project 2025 calls for is freezing literally immediately freezing all of the existing treaties that the Biden government has in place now, and then reversing all climate protection. So who benefits? You have to ask, who benefits from this agenda? This is an agenda that is designed to benefit certainly the billionaire class that is putting money into this plan, major corporations, and on a global level as well. So it's critical to understand that we're talking about a big profit motive that is underneath this plan. And once people understand that, they understand why people who are on the right are supporting it. Why do we have billionaires supporting this? Because they're going to make an enormous amount of money. And so even though they understand that the democracy is being dismantled, they will have more power and they will make more money. And if you look at the Orban regime or Poland, that is what we have. We have an enormous corruption. And we have what people are saying about Project 2025 is that it will produce essentially a politicization of an administration that we have never seen in the United States.
You are listening to Radio Gag, the Gays Against Guns show, our special podcast on Project 2025. Next, J.W. Walker explains how Project 2025 would profoundly change the enforcement capabilities of the ATF, the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms.
Jay, you had mentioned to me the other day for the GVP movement, the weakening of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is also imminent. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that could affect the gun violence that we're dealing with right now?
Sure, Libby. So if folks will remember, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms was traditionally, prior to 9/11, a part of the Treasury Department, because it was about taxation. It was about, you know, it was about going after the bootleggers because they were making money. They weren't paying the taxes on the hooch that they were making in the bathtub and running up and down the East Coast during Prohibition, right? Like that's kind of where it came from. The same thing with tobacco. So you can grow your own tobacco or your cigarettes, sell them on the street corner, whatever, not pay taxes. That was, and the same with firearms to a lesser degree. And after 9/11, the Bureau, particularly because of the firearms part of that Bureau, rather than splitting the Bureau apart, they moved the entire Bureau of ATF into the Department of Homeland Security, which gave it a law enforcement, a huge law enforcement component, and allowed it to coordinate with other areas of law enforcement, both on the international level and on the national level. And the key provision in Project 2025 related to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is that is moved back into Treasury. And so they are putting sort of a wall by moving it back into Treasury. They're kind of putting a wall between ATF and law enforcement. And so all of those tools that exist within Homeland Security to do sort of broad, comprehensive work to ferret out ghost guns or to go after 3D printed guns and people that are doing them, or internet sales, things like that, get severely diminished by ATF no longer being attached to law enforcement. But then the other part of it, the other place where gun violence intersects with Project 2025 is what AC was talking about, which is that demonization, criminalization, otherization of so many different groups throughout the country. When you put that next to this long-standing right-wing coming civil war narrative that many of the religious right, the sort of evangelical right, have been pushing, this whole coming civil war narrative since the 80s, what you're going to see is a greater threat of all kinds of violence against LGBTQIA plus people, particularly trans people, who have for years and years and years faced the greatest amount of hate and violence among our LGBTQIA plus community. You're going to see more of that, because, as we saw during Trump, the rise in hate crimes during Trump, because he made it okay. He took these things that were verboten, taboo, to say certain things, to use this racialized hate speech, as well as genderized hate speech and sexuality related hate speech. He sort of made it okay. And what we saw during the 4 years of the Trump administration was a rise in hate crimes across the board. Hate crimes against LGBTQ people, hate crimes against Arab Americans, hate to all Asian people during the early days of the COVID pandemic. And again and again and again, all sorts of groups were otherized and therefore became subject to violence. And so what you will see from this sort of organized hatred that is being promulgated in Project 2025 is you will inevitably see an increase in gun violence against LGBTQ people, against Black people, against immigrants, and down the line. Because we know this from any study of history, that when there is any kind of acceptance of a diminishment of any group of people, violence against those people becomes greater.
Of course, we know the profit motive of the gun industry, which is short. There will be no regulation on gun sales and who gets them. So that's also going to help.
You know, I wanted to add something that is really important. This plan is fundamentally a plan of militarizing the U.S. and its police force and its border patrol. And it actually calls for synthesizing and pulling all the different components that do border control now and putting them into a larger Uber agency. It would be the third largest agency in the federal government with cabinet level authority. And it also calls for bringing in federal troops. So, you know, the army and soldiers, and taking them out of sort of administrative desk jobs, wherever they are in different places, and putting them at the service of border control, but also domestic law enforcement. So they're working with the FBI, and to be able to, you know, even do what we're calling, you know, more control of situations that are considered to maybe be threats to national security. And we've heard about this is essentially a kind of form of saying, we're going to be concerned about domestic terrorism, quote unquote. And we saw this. We saw this in Black Lives Matter. We saw this at different times where it's essentially a way of trying to police dissent. And it's really important for people who are in progressive groups or leftists or whatever activists to understand that there's going to be an attempt to crack down. And so Project 2025 itself doesn't name the Insurrection Act. But people who are in the Project 2025 circle and who have been interviewed and have been speaking out are talking, and certainly the Trump administration and the Trump circle, you know, which is, you know, people who are also architects of Project 2025, right? They have talked about the resurrection of the Insurrection Act, which would essentially allow the president to declare a national security concern and bring in this level of, you know, of militarization of the response and surveillance. And so it's really about beefing up, you know, armed surveillance of the American people and making sure that anyone who tries to speak out is going to be threatened and potentially criminalized. So it means that all of us, what we're talking about today, you know, what we would be doing could be recategorized as a form of, you know, potentially domestic terrorism. It's not like we're looking at this and saying, oh, how far could they go? This is really all in this document. They don't hide their intention. They're stating it straightforward way. You know, we need to basically go after what we would consider to be this kind of, you know, anti-American, quote unquote, leftism, quote unquote, wokeism, quote unquote, unpatriotic, quote unquote, language. So I think that that's why it's important. But I do want to talk about some victories, because I think it's important for people to understand that we have to fight back, and we can, and we have tools. One big one was just yesterday, where we saw that one agency in the government, the Office of Management and Budget, was able to put through, after a couple of months of open for public commentary, a rule that requires any change of position of someone who is in the federal government, who is in an apolitical, you know, career position. They have to go through a process if they want to move those people and suddenly make them political appointees, which is such a linchpin of Project 2025. They were hoping to go in on day one. They've already got a big pack of executive orders already written, ready to go, to say, all right, we're going to like make all these people in all these different jobs. We're going to make their jobs be what's called at-will jobs. We're going to make them political appointees, which essentially creates a vacancy. And in that way, we can put all our people into these acting positions. And in 3 months, we're going to give them an instruction kit. It's a 180-day plan, quote unquote. And they're going to go in and we're going to help them make all these policy changes. And in the first 3 months of power, we're going to have fundamentally, you know, sort of dismantled the government. We're going to have hijacked. We're going to have rewritten the rules. Well, this ruling that passed yesterday by the Biden administration is now law. Is going to make it a lot harder. It's going to gunk up the wheels at the very least. It's going to have to be that if you want to replace someone, you're going to have to go through a process. These are merit positions. They're union protected. And so it could be that if a new administration comes in, if the Republicans win, they could go in and eventually change it and pass another kind of rule, but it's going to take them a lot longer. So already we've had one big victory. Another one is that right now, the tool to do this, which is called Schedule F, which is an executive order under Trump that was, you know, created and very short-lived because he didn't win because he lost the election, is something that that they want to resurrect. And there is right now a bill that's been before the, you know, going through the Congress. Doesn't have enough votes yet, but it's gaining more votes. In fact, bipartisan votes. And so they're hoping to bring Schedule F up for a vote before November. That would be, again, basically saying that it is it's not legal, right, to just suddenly take someone who is in a merit-based position in which they've had to show and prove why they deserve to be in that position and simply overnight put them into a transitional position where they can be fired and they lose their federal benefits. Project 2025 also seeks to get rid of all federal unions. And so the unions, whether it's we're in touch with the National Federation of Federal Employees. There's also the NTEU, the AFL-CIO. They're really mobilizing because, it's not just federal workers. Think about it. Who is a federal worker? That's your postal person. I mean, that's your doctors. And all these different agencies. There are so many Americans who are in jobs who would be impacted. So we're really needing to protect them. We're talking about tens of thousands potentially of employees. That's who Project 2025 is gunning for. So I think it's very important to show that we've already had a victory and there's much more to do. There are some other legislative pieces in different sectors of government. And so on our website, which is stopthecoup2025.org, we are bringing forward that information, and we will be putting under our resources as well, things that people can do. If you look at, we recently put up a paper about labor, and that includes what you can do wherever you are. I mean, certainly one thing people can do immediately is familiarize themselves with Project 2025, look at how it impacts them wherever they are. You're listening to this, you're in your kitchen, maybe you work in a daycare center, maybe you work in a hospital, maybe you work in a union. Maybe, you know, wherever you are, this plan is going to impact you. So see how it impacts you and talk to other people. You know, clone yourself, make yourself 100 people, talk to other people, and then tell people in your community, tell people in your workplace. That's number one. Number two is see how it may impact you and what are things you can do between now and maybe November to be able to take stock about how it might impact you. We're going to be providing a lot of preparedness tools, right? Preparing not just for what might happen in 2025, but right now, there are a lot of lessons, as I say. Things are happening now. Look what's happened in Florida. Look at Don't Say Gay. Look at the attacks on DEI in every campus. Okay? How are we fighting back? There are a lot of lessons. So we're going to bring forward, and we invite people to share the lessons that they have. There are many groups mobilizing, many resources. And a lot of what we have to do right now is like a giant PR job. We need to get the word out way beyond progressive communities. We need to get it out in Spanish, in other languages. We need to understand what matters to people. So we're also inviting people who are listening to look at our social media. Jay has been our social media manager. He's doing a terrific job. We have a lot of information that goes out on social media, whether it's Instagram or on Facebook or YouTube or Thread. Please consider looking at it and helping to amplify the information. And we will keep tracking. So, you know, we're really very proactive here. We think that if Americans know about this, and if people who are not Americans, who are living in the United States, know about this, they are not going to be in support of this agenda. And that includes, you know, Republicans who may think that they're voting for Trump. And when they see this, they may have to think twice, because our fundamental civil rights are under attack here in a very, very profound way and systematically. And we've seen what happens in other countries when this has happened. So we know what could happen. And our job is to get the word out and to bring forward lots of strategies to make it a lot harder for that agenda to go forward.
And Libby, if I could just add in one other piece of this, which is that being the social media manager for this campaign, they've seen a lot of the reactions of people to folks like us putting out the, you know, putting out the word about Project 2025. And there's very much a "that can't happen here" attitude, that this is, you know, people just refuse to believe it. And what I want people to understand is that the people who have written this are people with years and decades in cases of governmental experience. Like AC said, these are people that know how the government works and they know how to get around things. One of the key pieces of their plan is, you know, normally when a new president comes into office and they want to appoint their secretaries of all the various departments, each one of those secretaries has to go through a Senate confirmation process. However, there's a loophole to that. That is, if you have someone at a high enough but a high enough lower level within that department, you can elevate them to an acting secretary position. And an acting secretary doesn't have to go through the Senate process. So when you combine that with that, you know, with the Schedule F, you can see how they can literally get someone who is just an extreme Christian nationalist soldier in the position of authority, the key position of authority at every single federal agency. So this is not something that is like some wild fantasy. People should also remember, like AC mentioned, that the first mandate for leadership was in the Heritage Foundation's infancy, was essentially presented to Ronald Reagan. Was presented to him after he was inaugurated in 1981. And through the course of his presidency, 60% of what the Heritage Foundation set before him as policy goals got enacted, got made law, got put into practice. And so these people know what they are doing. This is, and you know, to go back to the LGBTQ thing, this is a global process, this global move to sort of neo-fascist authoritarianism and oligarchy. This is happening across Europe especially, but we've seen it in other places. We saw it in the Philippines with Duterte. We saw, you know, we obviously we've seen it in you know, countries like North Korea, etc. And remember all the guys that Donald Trump, you know, expressed all of his admiration for. It was all of these authoritarian strongmen. And on the LGBTQ front, look what just happened in Russia. Literally, they just essentially declared LGBTQ identity as inherently terrorist. They literally just said that if you are advocating for LGBTQ people, you are essentially a terrorist. So this is not science fiction. This is not some dystopian novel. This is a very well thought out plan that every different lever that needs to be pulled has been considered. And so if the American people don't educate themselves on it and actively fight against it, you know, this could actually happen.
Yeah. And I just want to say on the global level that people need to understand that we need to go back to the Christian theocracy piece of it, because the goal is to align all domestic and foreign policy on a what we would call, it's the quote unquote pro-family agenda, right? It's the anti-choice, anti-diversity, anti-LGBTQIA, so that with, for example, USAID, they want to make it essentially a kind of pro-life agency, so that if you want to get money from the US government, whatever sector you're in, you have to agree to implement that agenda or you will not get money. And it means that also, again, as you just mentioned, Jay, you know, the criminalization piece. I mean, they talk about how the US should not be taking a position or boycotting governments who are criminalizing LGBTQIA places, you know, like in Uganda, like we've just seen this past week. This is, again, because the people who are behind Project 2025 are the same people who are putting in place the judicial agenda of these anti-gay bills in Africa. They are literally, they're working with conservative pastors, giving them the legal template, coaching them, bringing them money. So to understand that this anti-democratic authoritarian agenda that's being advanced in areas like abortion and LGBTQIA, it's part of a bigger agenda. It's about implementing Christian right theocracy, not just in the US, but globally. And they also don't hide it. It's not like we're coming and saying, oh, look what they're doing. This is really written openly in this document. They're making no bones about it. You know, in the area of abortion, it's not just a matter of, for example, they want to extend what's called the Mexico City policy to global, right? They want to make a federal global ban. They want to ban it, but they also want to go after, you know, birth control. So look at what that is agenda mean. It's a lot of it is about white supremacy, advancing whiteness, being concerned about in immigration, for example, you're going to lock up, you know, tens of thousands of immigrants and put them in camps and deport them. And you're going to make it, you know, to extend the visas for maybe white elites to come in from European countries. That agenda is a whiteness agenda. That is a racist agenda. And it's very much, it's not that the evangelical movement is all white. In fact, that's not at all true. There's a lot of Latino evangelicals and Black evangelicals who are very conservative, right? But the agenda itself is about whiteness. It's a big fear of, you know, whites being replaced. It's the great replacement theory. All of that is within this. And so we have on our website a document, which I'd really encourage your listeners to take a look at. It's called Unpacking the Propaganda of Project 2025, to understand that this whole document is written in such a way, it's so wonky. Again, we're like, who would read it? Well, we did, right? But when you really take apart the rhetoric, it's very fascinating. Not only does it really reveal this agenda, but we've had some colleagues who are real specialists, who are themselves raised in a very extremist Christian or religious Christian culture. And they've said, you know, we should go through this document and literally underline all the lines that are lifted from, you know, interpretations of the Bible. So it's almost like a big wink, wink to extremist Christians, because so much of the document is reflecting this kind of narrative. It's very patriarchal. It has a very anti-woman view. It says, you know, women should basically be kind of like a 1950s view, like women should be taking care of their men. And it's, again, extremely white. You know, it favors, you know, it wants to do things like favor married couples with children only. Those are the sort of the only legitimate families, right? It wants to cut funding for single women, cut, you know, things like school meals for families. We know who they're talking about. It's about diminishing any support for people who are living in lower income. It's also very much white, and it's very much about centralizing the power of a class of people who are anxious about losing it. And the irony is, of course, we know that these religious groups have been losing power tremendously. The biggest growing group is the Latino evangelicals, but we are talking about a minority. And I'm just going to keep making this point. The majority of Americans are not behind this plan. A minority of people, a small minority of people, is pushing this plan. There's a great number of people in the US who are not going to vote, or maybe are feeling like they don't know enough to vote with this kind of information. And so, you know, social change does get made by small groups of people, right? And so we need to awaken a lot more people to this. But I think the place where I continually find hope is I know that the bulk of the people in this country do not support this agenda. They are they believe in the U.S. They believe in the story of the United States. We are a nation of immigrants. They believe in the story of checks and balances and separation of church and state and all of that. That's what's under attack. So I think that if we can let them know what's on, you know, how they're attacked, we stand a chance. But we do have a lot of work to do to get the word out.
Well, that is a lot to present to our listeners.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. I thank you both for getting our listeners who may not have known about this, getting them started. For me, it was the demonstration we went to with you at the Heritage Foundation. Mm-hmm. And I came back hair on fire after I heard you speak there. So I really urge everyone who's listening to this podcast to please familiarize yourself with the Project 2025 agenda. Visit the website, stopthecoup2025.org. And on our homepage for this podcast, I've also put several other links that explain in long form and shorter form the scope of this project and how it will affect our country and our individual lives. Again, thank you both. Jay, can you tell us when and where the demonstration will be this week?
Yes, it's going to be Saturday at the southwest corner of Central Park, traditionally known as Columbus Circle. A lot of our friends like to call it Lenape Circle. It's going to be at 1 p.m. We're going to do a great sort of informational kind of street theater. There's going to be some singing. Some folks who might remember Sing Out Louise. The old gang is getting back together again with some new songs geared toward Project 2025. And I also want to ask our Radio Gag listeners to please follow at Stop the Coup 2025 on all the social media platforms. We're on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, Threads, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, all the ones that are at signs, just at Stop the Coup 2025. So please follow us. You can see videos from our from that rally that we held at the Heritage Foundation. You can see links to all the different reports on our websites. We're also on LinkedIn. Just anywhere there's socials, you can follow us there. And please come out to Columbus Circle next Saturday. And I'll be there, and a bunch of other folks will be there trying to educate New Yorkers and tourists about the dangers of Project 2025.
Okay, thank you again.
To find out more about working with us, please follow us at Gays Against Guns NY on Facebook and Instagram. We meet once a month at the LGBT Center on 13th Street in Manhattan and on Zoom. Email gagsignup@gmail.com and we'll provide you with a Zoom link and details for our upcoming meetings, which are held on the last Thursday of each month at 7 p.m. Everyone is welcome at any and all gag events. And you can donate to support the work of GAG through the link on our Instagram bio at Gays Against Guns NY. In addition to our monthly street actions, we are currently producing a documentary about Gays Against Guns by filmmaker Paul Rowley. Well, that's our podcast for today. We thank you for listening. We are back with a new episode almost every week. And don't forget, you can listen to our previous shows at any time on any major podcast platform. Our shows are also featured on BRIC, Brooklyn Free Speech Radio. Please subscribe to our podcast so you'll be notified when the new shows drop. We leave you with our fabulous singing quartet, Sing Out Louise.
A go, 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 go. Are you Russian hoe?